BP wants to drill.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, good morning to you. I'm Bob Moon in for Steve Chiotakis, and we've got a global perspective for you this hour, how business and economic news abroad is affecting us here in the U.S. The near future of deep water drilling in the Gulf of Mexico could be decided in a case that begins today. A federal judge in New Orleans will hear arguments over whether the six-month ban on the drilling is legal. That ban has idled dozens of offshore drilling spots in the Gulf, many of which happen to be operated by BP. Marketplace's Stephen Beard joins us live from London now. Good morning.
Hello, Bob.
How critical is this offshore moratorium for BP?
It's pretty important. BP derives around 10% of its revenues from the Gulf. Obviously, all the oil companies operating there want this moratorium to come to an end. And it seems many people along the Gulf Coast who derive employment and revenue from the oil rigs, servicing the rigs and so on, they also want the moratorium to be scrapped. So it's not just BP and the oil companies.
And what about BP's longer-term future in the Gulf? How's that looking?
On the face of it, it's looking a bit more secure. BP's been talking to the Obama administration about finance and is now apparently close to a deal whereby it will use all its oil revenues from the Gulf to guarantee payments into that $20 billion compensation fund. Now, that seems to guarantee BP's continued presence in the Gulf, but as oil analyst Nick McGregor points out, this only secures the company's existing production in the Gulf.
I think the real difficulty comes with access to future drilling rights. And if BP were to be shut out of that area, then I think that shareholders would take a very dim view.
And he says there is this move in Congress to ban oil companies with poor safety records from getting new drilling licenses, it is still possible BP could be shut out of future Gulf exploration.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Thank you.
Okay, Bob.
China is coping with the effects of a different kind of disaster. The government in Beijing reports prices in the country spiked up in July. Massive flooding disrupted food supply routes, and it drove prices of food upward. Chinese officials say they are blaming heavy rain for all the problems, but as Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports, some are pointing to China's rapid development as the culprit, too.
For decades, industrial logging in this remote part of the country helped drive China's construction boom and economic growth. It also laid the hillsides bare. But it didn't stop there, says environmentalist Wen Bo. He says local officials, fueled by government funding, kept going back to the hillsides for raw material to build more.
They have to get material from this mountain. They have to dig the rock and get a lot of building material from this area. So this makes this area less stable.
Bo, who works for the U.S.-based Pacific Environment, says the massive death toll could have been prevented had local officials paid closer attention to sustainable growth and city planning instead of rapid urbanization.
They feel like, you know, by looking at the image of Shanghai, by looking at the image of Beijing, they feel like our development needs more tall buildings.
Chinese government officials have avoided blaming the disaster in Gansu province on unchecked development. They say it's a result of record rainfall in the country. China's being hit with the worst flooding in a decade. Thousands have died, and more than 12 million people have had to evacuate their homes. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
The value of the yen is on the rise, which didn't help stocks in Asia today. Let's do the numbers. Tokyo's Nikkei closed down almost 2.75%. Investors are apparently worried over fresh concerns for the U.S. economy now that the Federal Reserve has decided to try pumping in more money to help jumpstart bank lending. European stocks are in the doldrums, too. The Dow lost 54 points yesterday.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Yellow Book 360, offering a spectrum of marketing tools for small businesses designed to go beyond yellow. More at yellowbook360.com.
India is fighting to remain a hub for the global spice industry. Its spice trading hasn't always been a blessing for India, what with Portuguese, Dutch, and British colonials often fighting over it. Now, some there are concerned about foreign companies muscling in on India's lucrative industry. Raymond Thibodeau reports from New Delhi.
This Delhi spice bazaar, known as the Kari Baoli, is one of India's biggest spice markets. Shoppers browse among burlap sacks brimming with cumin and bright orange turmeric powders, curries and black pepper, which explains the sneezing as people walk by. Varun Grover owns a spice shop and an exporting business here. He says India's love of spices runs deep.
Yeah, it's a source of national pride. Indian spices are the best spices in all over the world, so no other country can come and take over it.
But the biggest food companies in the U.S. and Europe are eyeing India's market, including McCormick. The Maryland-based spice giant is buying a stake in an Indian company called Eastern Condiments, mainly for a bigger foothold in India's domestic market. Alan Wilson is McCormick's CEO.
It's the largest market in the world for spice production and consumption. We've been sourcing from India for over 100 years, so we have a long relationship there.
But Indian spice traders like Grover are worried. They don't like foreign companies muscling in on their turf. Some exporters say it's unfair, since Indian spice merchants often have trouble accessing foreign markets, especially in the U.S.
We have expertise in selling in those markets. We can certainly help them with the quality expectations and access to those markets.
That's exactly what Sri Kumar is hoping for. He's deputy director of India's Spice Board, which has been trying to attract and partner with foreign companies.
The Indian companies can have more access in foreign markets. And similarly, the foreign markets, they can promote their brand in India also. So it's a mutually beneficial thing.
Kumar says it's hard to know who benefits more. But one thing is certain. Despite the global economic slowdown, Indian spice exports are on the rise. Last year, $1.2 billion worth of spices were shipped out of the country, an all-time high. In New Delhi, I'm Raymond Thibodeau for Marketplace.
And while we're on the subject of global food sales, don't mess with an international icon like the Pillsbury Doughboy. A cookie entrepreneur in Salt Lake City found out that's a recipe for trouble. Tammy Cromar called her little gourmet bakery and frozen dough business My Dough Girl. But General Mills, which owns the Pillsbury brand, told her that was too similar to its iconic Doughboy and would diminish the value of its trademark. She figures she doesn't have the legal pockets to go up against a company that makes that much dough. It had global sales of almost $16 billion last year, so she's agreed to find a new name for her small business. And I always thought that little guy was all warm, sweet, and giggly.
Woo-hoo!
I'm Bob Moon in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Morning Report.
American Public Media. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.